Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for July 14, 2022, in the ongoing series, the year-long compendium of shows talking about the history of my discoveries with anecdotes, experiences, putting into perspective the history, what was going on at the time, etc. And last week, I brought up the topic of the Colburn. The Colburn came to me through a series of events. A friend who was very helpful in getting information for me and was a big supporter of my work and my history, understood what I had been through. And he was searching for these books, of which his grandma, when he was a little kid, sat him down and showed him these books, which turned out to be the Bronze Book of England. And he also knew that there were more of these, and in fact, an entire library that existed, but only in closed circles. So this was only a limited group of people who had access to this. And so anyway, the Colburn, like I said, there were three copies. The first three copies that came into the U.S. from the Chaldean Trust, one went to Bill, who pursued this and got it. The other, his friend Dick, who was running a research group, and then one to me. So I open up this book, this beautifully bound book with the Celtic symbol on the cover, and I start reading it, and of course with my background in the comets and the large comets, the ones that do the serious damage, etc., and the tidal waves that it causes, the mountain building, the severe destruction, and then also knowing the absolute devastating effect it would have on people who survived this. And I start reading the Colburn and talking about the birth of man and the rebirth of man. And clearly they're talking about sky monsters. These are the big comets, and there's multiple of them doing battle up in the sky. And reading this, and the hair is standing up on the back of my neck. Literally, and I cannot believe what they are describing is exactly what you would see if two large comets or more were doing battle up in the sky. And now let's go back to, say, Velikovsky's work, where he's only talking about the comet Venus. In this case, so we're talking about another event, and it's very possible. Well, it's hard to say, but Hale-Bopp, knowing that Hale-Bopp had been in the solar system 4,200 years ago, this is prior to 1995, just calculate backwards, and put it really about since it had lost part of its orbit. The last time that was here, because every cycle it loses orbital period, and that's why also these people that say it comes back every 3,600 years, planet X or something, that's not the way it works. It loses energy, in fact, probably half of that every time it comes back. But that would put it about, let's say, about 3,000 BC, which would very well have been the time of the Noah's Flood, or earlier. I mean, it's hard to say, but very possibly, the other thing that happens is these comets don't always come near Earth. As in the case of Hale-Bopp, it was not even near Earth, and it really was not a Earth-affecting comet directly. It had a lot of activity with the sun, etc. The sun was going bananas during those 6 years that Hale-Bopp was here. It was causing a tremendous amount of solar flaring, solar activity, etc. And those flares affected Earth. We had hurricanes with 300-mile-an-hour winds. We had X flares, two or three per day. It drained the power of the solar capacitor to the point where the sun is still trying to build up the solar capacitor. But that comet had been in the solar system before, and possibly part of what the Colburn is talking about. These multiple giant comets up in the sky at the same time doing battle and having a tremendous effect on planet Earth. And clearly one of the events, the rebirth, so-called rebirth of man in the Colburn, is talking about the Venus event. And I want to fast forward a little bit here to a very special researcher who I've been communicating with actually for years now regarding the colbrand. This researcher comes out of the United Kingdom. Her name is Yvonne Whiteman, and you can find her work on the internet establishing and correlating the events in the colbrand with real events in history. And so, and very excellent work, very excellent work. I highly recommend. And I believe she has a compository of her articles now in two books on the internet. But just look up Yvonne Whiteman and you will find them. Highly recommend that you read them. But anyway, there was immediately some question as to the authenticity of the colbrand. And a book like this has authenticity because of its content and relating to other things, because these ancient people just could not just make this up, or even somebody 20 years ago or 30 years ago could not simply make this up out of thin air, because the current scientific belief is so dominant that comets are these little things, and to have this information, we know, for example, from the Solon, the great uncle of Aristotle, who went back to Egypt and asked the Egyptians, we have cross references, the Egyptian priests that were in existence when Aristotle's great uncle Solon went back, and many of the ancient Greeks, the very learned, these were the early Greeks, in what we consider the early Greeks, went to Egypt to be trained. And they told him, they said, you don't know where things came from or where your society came from. That they explained to the Greeks that they were the descendants of sheep herders up in the mountains who survived this tremendous catastrophe, and that the prior Greek civilization was in a worldwide battle with Atlantis. And this is one of the big references that we understand with Atlantis. And all of a sudden, one day, Atlantis just sank under the ocean. And it was a slewing operation. That is there. It's in the South China Sea. Getting ahead of myself a little bit here, because that I describe in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colbrand Connection, which was published in 2002, I believe. And but anyway, back to the colbrand. So this is cross-referencing the same information that occurred, that we know came from other sources. But the colbrand talks about the people. And this is what really made the hair stand up on the back of my neck, is when they talk about the people that came through these events and how they are absolutely physically and mentally destroyed. I mean, now I've been in an earthquake, a 7.0, and it lasted probably about a minute, the major quake, and of course then you have the aftershocks, etc. But let me tell you, it shakes your world, and that's 1 minute, and it was nothing. I would estimate that the Venus event, for example, Earth was probably experiencing like a 20 on the Richter scale earthquake event. We have mountain building going off, we have all the buildings just crumbling to the ground, etc. And amazing destruction. The pyramids of the early Olmecs, which were the precursors of the Mayans, what we call the Mayans, the 800 AD Mayans, going back a number of thousand years, where the Quetzalcoatl event actually happened. So these people maintained their history for literally thousands of years, just like we maintain history of, the, for example, Christ and other events that took place thousands of years ago. We still maintain the history. And so likewise, the Mayans maintained the history of Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky. But they rebuilt their cities on the old gridwork that was prior to the pole shift. We've corroborated this with other things, like my discovery of the Nazca Lines, which I did in 2015, that they were fractal antenna complex. But some of them are built on the gridwork, the old gridwork that had the North Pole up in the Hudson Bay area. That's another entire story. I've already talked about surveying the Mayan ruins in the mid-1990s. I went to Mexico with surveying equipment, surveyed a number of the major cities and then cross-triangulated those baselines to discover that the Old North Pole on which these cities were built were in Hudson Bay. And of course, that's been corroborated by many new people. But back to the Colbrin and the condition of man after these events. Okay, so in summary, the Colbrin is a seminal piece of information that is really essential glue connecting us to the past. And I'm just going to go forward a little bit. I'll probably mention this during the time frame, but I have been talking to people about Atlantis and the Colbrin and the events, and of course my discoveries with Tesla. And then in my studies of Tesla, I understood that Tesla's father was the curator of the Vatican Museum in Slovakia? I forget which Eastern European country Tesla was, his father was there. By the way, that church was blown up by Bill Clinton. What a moron. That church was blown up in one of his policing exercises. But anyway, Tesla had access to these documents that were ancient documents. And I always said that it was when Tesla built his Wardenclyffe Tower, for example, he just built the big one, and it would be the equivalent of building a 747 by the Wright brothers. You know, that's how extreme it was from normality. And he did not build a little model and then build a bigger one, then a bigger one, then a bigger one. He just built the big one that had the capability of penetrating all the way through the atmosphere and reaching the ionosphere. So to me, that tells me that he had some information there from the ancient text. So anyway, I was bridging this gap in history between the ancients of Atlantis, who clearly were using atmospheric electricity in the five-ring city, I've talked about that, and Tesla, who was recovering this information and putting it into practice in the Wardenclyffe Tower and in Colorado Springs. And of course, he died in 1943. So this is a long time ago. And so I'm discovering where the vertical electric field comes from, something Tesla did not understand, and also the entire scope of electric fields in the solar system, the discharge of the solar capacitor by Earth and all the other planets, the connections to weather, etc. And so anyway, the people said, you got to write a book about this. Well, I already had in 2001, my book Planet X Comets and Earth Changes came out, which was literally an international bestseller. And people like, I was on radio shows like Clay Douglas, Alex Merklinger. These were the big shows of the day back in the early 2000s, and the Art Bell Show, of course, and the list would go on and on and on. Talking about this, I believe, with Jeff Rentz, and the big radio shows of the day. And so anyway, people said, you've got to write this down. But my first book was Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, which blew the lid off of the whole CIA disinformation program that was raging at the time. Crazy Lady Talks to Aliens, We're All Gonna Die, May 15, 2003, that whole thing. And anyway, my second book to come out was the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, which was a supplement to the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. And so I always release them on the Coast to Coast AM show. And so anyway, when Atlantis to Tesla came along, I made arrangements and I sent it to George Norrie. He was the only one to have a copy of the book on Coast to Coast AM. By then, Clear Channel had come in and taken over the radio show from Art Bell, and George Norrie was the host there. And so I had pre-sold the Atlantis to Tesla book without announcing the name, without announcing the title of the book, and it sold quite well. And interestingly enough, this is now jumping up into 2002, talking about the Atlantis to Tesla book, which was the culmination of all of this had happened back in the 90s and before. And so I write this book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. And when George Norrie announces the name on the radio, my webpage goes banana. I sold $42,000 of that book that night. And the limit on my merchant account at the time was only $5,000. So the next day, of course, I get a notification from my merchant account saying you have gone way over your limit. And of course, they're holding the money for all of these orders. So they made me send the books out. And of course, this was many printings of the book. I only had one printing of the book ready, not anticipating this. But I had many of the printings of the book sold in that night. Because I think the book was $14.95, you know, I mean, do the numbers. And so the end result was my merchant company made me send out all of the books and confirm that the people had received them before they would give me the money. And so that put me in kind of a bind because I had to go out and print all these books, send them out, keep track of the receipt by the recipients, and they went all over the world. So anyway, I got it back. I got done. I, you know, demonstrated that because they were worried that this was a scam, that all of a sudden I was doing less than $5,000 a month in business back in the early 2000s. And all of a sudden I have $42,000 in a single night. So anyway, very interesting story, but people loved that book. They still do. And a friend of mine, in fact, Bill, the guy that got me the Colburn, he said, I employed more people with that book and caused more interest than any other book that had been written for a long time. Because everybody all of a sudden became a Tesla expert, a Colburn expert, Atlantis expert, etc. And secret societies was in there. It talked about secret societies. And I remember George Norrie asked me, he said, now explain to us what's a secret society, because it was a new topic. And I was talking about the ancient priest cults, etc. And, anyway, it's just a little fast forward, a very interesting time getting up into the 2002 era. And, of course, by that time, I had my own radio show. So going back, let's get back into the 1990s, because a lot of interesting things going on. Here, I still have quite a bit to discuss about my corroboration with the Russian scientists. But interestingly enough, the CIA did not get Art Bell on their first attempt blaming him for the suicide of 37 people in Los Angeles, the Heaven's Gate people, which, as I said, was a mass murder. It was not a mass suicide. Because the CIA was after them because of the whole issue of drawing in this massive crowd of people, over 30,000 people, converging on Los Angeles to go out and sit in Hollywood Hills and occupy it and put their psychological powers together at the same time that the CIA was aware that Planet X was coming in, which freaked them out completely anyway. And then as it exploded into, not exploded, as it ignited into this huge comet, which they didn't expect, they started hearing intelligence signaling from that region, indicating that there was alien spacecraft. And this is not me talking. This is what I learned from the intelligence agencies. Okay, so at any rate, the Planet X disinformation campaign in the late 90s and early 2000s is raging. It's on every talk show host. Everybody's talking about this. It is the subject of the day. And of course, my work, once again, in this massive international controversy, turns out to be central to everything going on. I want to talk a little bit about Carl Sagan here, because he dies in December of 1996. This is about the same time as the announcement of the discovery of X-rays in comets, something that he would have never anticipated, which confirms my work. And of course, Carl was instrumental in me being bounced out of Cornell two times, not once. But he leaves his legacy of global warming, because I don't know if you know this, but all of the global climate change and everything that's going on today, all the hubbub was originated by none other than Carl Sagan. Because the original story, here's how it all came about. The Venus was anticipated to be an Earth-like planet because it was in the Goldilocks zone. They just thought it was kind of a rather cloudy planet. And they really didn't know much about it, the spin rate or anything like that. It did not have a moon. But there was really no knowledge about Venus. And then when the first Russian space probe, Venera, went in and landed on the surface of Venus and measured its surface temperature hot enough to melt lead, all of a sudden NASA had a problem, because it was corroborating the idea that Venus was a brand new planet. And so they had to come up with some solution. They had to come up with an excuse. And so Carl Sagan is the one that brings up the charge, because, of course, this high temperature on Venus would corroborate Velikovsky's story that Venus was recently a large comet that was becoming a planet. It was in its formative stage, etc. So they had some backpedaling to do, and Carl Sagan is the one that grabbed the banner and raced up to the front of the line and said it's the greenhouse effect, that all of this carbon dioxide in Venus's atmosphere was causing it to be so hot that it actually melted the planet. Well, it was not even a couple of weeks when people came out and they said, well, you know, there's a problem here. Because the Venera measured the winds on Venus, and there's no surface wind at all. There's no way for this, because then they realized, too, that Venus is not rotating. It's rotating very slowly. And interestingly enough, it always points the same side towards Earth, something like our moon does, indicating that it had a recent gravitational interaction with Earth, a tidal interaction, which would cause that lock. Where the Venus is, same side is always pointing towards Earth. Interesting. But at any rate, Venus has a very slow rotational period where it's essentially the same side pointing toward the sun for months at a time. So how does the heat from the sun in this greenhouse effect that's caused by the sun get around to the dark side and keep the temperature constant all around the surface of Venus? Well, you know, that was just the beginning of the problems. And, of course, then they realized that, well, Venus is not, that the greenhouse effect doesn't work. So Carl Sagan simply makes up a term. It's the exaggerated greenhouse effect. And so people said, well, you know, this is ridiculous. You just can't invent a term and make some problem go away. There's no physics involved here. And then the list of problems with the greenhouse effect kicked up. And then real scientists realized that the greenhouse effect did not work on Earth. But the point is that about that time is in the early 1990s was when this whole greenhouse effect came into play. And I went to the physics department at the university where I was teaching at the time, the state university system. And I said, look, this greenhouse effect is going to be the crux of all of, you know, control for the next 30 years. And I was absolutely correct, because it became the dominant consideration for everything that happened, you know, up to today. Then they called it the greenhouse effect, and then they called it global warming, and then, because they measured things where the Earth was actually cooling, they said it's global climate change. And this is the term that's stuck today. But this was, just want to let you know, Carl Sagan who initiated that. Carl Sagan, also famous for his Cosmos series, 1979 to 81 in Hollywood. When I was at Cornell, Carl was really not there much, because he was busy in Hollywood becoming a movie star. Other claim to fame for Carl Sagan, that he killed Velikovsky's entire message and made it completely illegal for anybody to talk about it or consider it ever again, because if you did, You would lose your tenure, you would lose your department, you would lose any, you would lose your ability to get grants or funding or publication. You would be politically blackballed from any ability to function as a scientist. And so, and by the way, that's why he got the Cosmos series, because he was the spokesperson that led the charge against Velikovsky. And also nuclear winter. Nuclear winter is something that came across that if there was a nuclear war and it blasted all of this soot up into the stratosphere, it could surround Earth and cause a nuclear winter, a winter that would not end caused by nuclear warfare, as if the nuclear fallout wouldn't kill anybody first. I don't think you'd have to worry about the nuclear winter, because the fallout, everybody would be dead long before the winter came. Anyway, be that as it may, that was Carl Sagan. And then UFOs. He poo-pooed UFOs. I don't have time for this silliness. That's Carl Sagan. And now everybody is coming out of the woodwork about UFOs, the government, the Navy, the Air Force. Everybody's talking about releasing the CIA. And so once again, Carl Sagan was talking the talking points of the day, but really not up to date with what was going on. Okay, so enough of that. I hope to be able to play a little bit of the Chuck Schrammick clip in this show. I'll see if I can get that in by the end. And also, I want to mention that in 1997, I went to an American Geophysical Union meeting, and this was a rather, let's just put it this way, confrontational meeting. This is where a joker, I will call him, Michael Muma from Goddard, came up to me at the American Geophysical Union meeting, and the poster I had at that meeting, it was a poster session that I had, and I was there at my poster session, and I had my computer with slides that were changing of comets, of the Schumacher-Levy 9 comet, of the comet Hale-Bopp, the comet with the 17 legs spraying out of it that was taken with a Swan filter, etc. And he comes up to me and confronts me, and he's very angry. But I've talked about this, where the students stood in the background. So there were about 20 graduate students. Like I said before, you can tell graduate students a mile away. You know, they got dumpy shoes, dumpy clothes, and they look like they're, you know, they've spent 20 years in a textbook. And of course, not well dressed, because they're, you know, they're not gainfully employed. They're living on a postdoc salary or whatever, you know. But at any rate, that poster is in my 3-poster set on my webpage. So if you have my books or my book library or the poster set that comes from my webpage, jmccsci.com, the 1997 American Geophysical Union poster is the poster. That's a mini example of the poster I had at this meeting. And of course, that was after the X-rays were discovered. That's when Michael Muma and Casey Liss of Goddard were basically doing their best to ignore me. And of course, I'm getting a lot of attention because of the whole issue with Hale-Bopp and international fame, you know, telling people that comets are not dirty snowballs, that they're plasma discharge comets, that the University of Hawaii astronomers lied and faked the photos, proving it on the air on international radio. So anyway, yeah, they were not too happy with me. Anyway, I don't want to go too much into that detail, but these are other things that were happening during this time frame. And then eventually, the Millennium Group webpage broke up. And I think it was just there was a tremendous amount of effort between the people. And like I say, I'm not going to mention names, because these people are still alive. I mentioned one name last week of a person who's passed on now since then. But I think there was just the stress of year after year, many years of dealing with this complete dominance and just complete destruction of any rational information coming out of the scientific community. And actually, it went on for a while, but eventually I got my own webpage and started posting there. And that's where the jmcanneyscience.com webpage came from, the early 2000s. Somewhere in that time frame, I transitioned from my material on the Millennium Group page to the jmcanneyscience.com page, which is the page I still have today. And in the year 2000 began my radio show. And it's on the same time slot, the same radio show, WWCR, Nashville, Tennessee, Tower Number 2, Thursday night, 6 p.m. Central Time. That show has been there since 2000. And so what we are now, 22 years into it, I'm still doing this show. It's commercial-free, has always been commercial-free. Never had any sponsors, never any support. The only support I get is from you, the listeners, buying my products, the water filters, etc. And by the way, that's where my water filter business began, because my first effort at the radio show, it was a deal that was set up by WWCR at the time to sell water filters, which I did. And then eventually got my own product line and, you know, migrated up to where we are today. And I'll talk more about the water filter company as we get into the 2000s, but I want to stick to the 1990s and kind of cap this off. So the other thing that was coming out of my work was the weather work, especially really did a lot of really good work with the Russians, understanding the hurricane manipulation, cyclonic storms, the cyclonic storms on Mars. The great red spot of Jupiter was a cyclonic storm. And how did that operate? Well, the reason it kept going around and around and around is because it was like a giant hurricane and there was nothing to short it out. There was no land mass to short out the hurricane, which is the great red spot of Jupiter. Where does oil come from on Earth? Well, it comes from the passage of Earth through the tail of these large comets. And that's why you find Earth in Earth's surface 20, 18 miles down, you find oil that's trapped there. And then a lot of surface built up, and then more oil, and then surface built up. So the Earth has been layering with buildup for millions of years. And so when people, scientists, pick up a rock or a piece of geology on the surface and they go, well, this is an indication of 4.5 billion year old Earth, it has nothing to do with what's down under the ground. We don't have any real record of the age of the Earth, nor of the age of the solar system. And the idea that it all started at one time, 4.5 billion years ago, is a Grimm's fairy tale nursery rhyme. That's the best thing you can say about it. They can't tell you where the water came from on Earth. My model does. It's part of the comet when the Earth was forming. The water is already there, and you can see that in Venus, which is a young planet. My work also explains how Venus got to the position it is with an orbit inside of Earth and how it worked its way in. It encountered Earth on two occasions as the orbit spiraled inwards and eventually became the planet Venus, which is the Mayan Popol Vuh, the statement of where Venus came from. And the surface features of Earth also the result of very dynamic processes when a large comet comes close to Earth. Mountain building, tsunamis, flooding, raining of oil and brimstone. That's the ancients talk about that, where the fire and brimstone, the naphtha, the burning naphtha comes in from the sky and burns everybody and burns the skin, they talked about, the ancients. In the meteor streams, and then the ancients predicting the future end of the world, the end times, not the end of the world, but just the end times for the human race, where you look up in the heavens and you see the moon turning to blood. We just had a blood moon. And so, the fact that there's a reflection or certain properties of being in the shadow of something that causes the moon to be red, or that could have also been due to massive volcanic flows on the surface of the moon because it was being disrupted, just like planet Earth was having massive volcanic flows, mountain building, etc. And so at any rate, the understanding. So when I eventually wrote my weather book in around 2004, the Principia Meteorologia, that's the one that followed the Atlantis to Tesla book, was the weather book. And in there, I describe Earth changes that follow a massive comet exchange. And I talk about the glaciers and how the Earth has to come out of this glaciation period, which we are right now. That's why we are truly experiencing global warming. It's not because of you driving your SUV up and down the road. It's because we are literally coming out of an ice age. When I was a young person, the Montana and the Wyoming glaciers were still there, and they have melted within my lifetime. The big glaciers in the West and in the Canadian Rockies were there and have melted literally within my lifetime. And so, and of course, that had been going on for thousands of years before I was born. Okay, I want to mention, too, just a little bit about my personal life. In 1996, remember, I had been teaching at the university level math. I'm sorry, not math. I was teaching physics, electronics, and astronomy. And all of a sudden, I get an opportunity to apply for a job in a telecommunications company, very similar to what I had been employed in the 1980s, a very high-paying, high-security job. And I went to take the test for this. And this is very interesting. And they gave out the general study, like books to go through, and I read through these and et cetera. And I was, of course, very familiar with telecommunications and telecommunication protocols, et cetera. And so there was a battery, I think it was somewhere between 11 and 15 tests on all these different subject topics that you had to be an expert in to work in this special. It was a special group with 90 engineers. And we worked 24/7, and what we did was we managed the national network for this company in the United States, a position called network engineering, literally. And so when I took the tests, the results came back, and I had in all the different 11 category tests the highest score of anybody who had ever taken those tests in every category. And so anyway, that's something that probably would be pretty difficult because a lot of these people were very long-term employees in that specific field. And so it was all different categories of knowledge in, relative to telecommunications and protocols and et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, but that's kind of a feather in my cap that is, I'm, you know, something to be proud of, that the, you know, I had the highest score in every category that had ever been achieved. And almost it would be impossible, I think, if you look at it, because there'd be somebody who really excelled in one of those areas. But at any rate, it began a job, a very good, high-paying job, very high security, once again, where I was invisible, not visible to the outside as an employee, etc. And I worked at that for another 15 years, literally to the day. And that's the last, what I would call, real job that I had. So that 15 years added to the 10 years puts me at 25 years in the telecommunications industry. So once again, just to review my, what I would call my curriculum vitae, my resume, if you were to look at the professional positions, 10 years teaching university level math, physics, computer science, astronomy, and electronics over the course of, you know, at various positions, and that would include the 2 years at Cornell, and then 25 years in the telecommunications industry at a high level of engineering. And so anyway, then of course I have my own companies, like I talked about the archery company that I ran for a bit, and that archery company ran for about 4 years. And then the all of the businesses that I've operated since the end of my last, what I call, real job. But there again, it allowed me a number of things, a good income, a secure income, privacy, so nobody knew where I worked. I would be on radio shows. I'd have my public life that was on radio shows, all my comet work, science work, etc., and going to meetings, American Geophysical Union meetings, and on and on and on. And the thing is that I learned, and that I've not only with my own case, but with a lot of other people, is they go after your income first, then they try and muddy up your name, then they try and copy your work or duplicate it or make it into crazy work or whatever. You know, I mean, they have all of these techniques to try and bring people down. And after all of these decades, I'm still here and on the top of my game and on the forefront of many different fields, some of them that are totally unrelated to my comet science and solar system and solar wind science and all of that. It's totally unrelated. But anyway, so very important for me to have had this position where I was simply out of sight and nobody knew where I was and couldn't find me. Okay, so I want to jump back a little bit talking about Carl Sagan. And I've talked about him before, and I've noted that in 1996 he passed away. And we should always consider the best in four people, even if they were arch enemies. But the reality is, for example, I mentioned the Cosmos series, which he set the stage for all of science that would come for decades and decades up until the current time. The Cosmos series is the most watched series in all of TV history, I believe. And the Cosmos book that goes along with it is the second most read book in the world next to the Gutenberg Bible. So this got heavily promoted right from the get-go. And then, of course, the Cosmos series was redone by Neil deGrasse Tyson. And by the way, in my education package, part of my original paid cast series, but now available in the education package that I sell online, is about 20-session program picking apart the Cosmos series point by point. And I want to point to that. I want to indicate that you should go look at that, because when you understand that was very skillfully crafted to promote atheist science, which is like the Big Bang. There was no design, and just all this stuff blew apart from nowhere. The protons, and I mean the organization in the universe was just random, and the planets evolved, and then the human beings evolved from little microorganisms, and there's just no plan. It's just all random, and there's no need for a designer. And this is the narcissism of scientists. They think they're so smart, even though it's very clear that we're just learning things for the very first time in a universe that has been here long before man has been around. And then to imagine that somehow man just evolved, just kind of clicked along this evolution thing. And, you know, just there's the planetary evolution, then there's the biological evolution. And just, you know, the promotion of this as an atheist science is the core of the Cosmos series. And so anyway, I recommend that you go to my education package and concentrate for certain on those 20 lectures dealing with the Cosmos series. And not only do I pick it apart, but I also replace it with real science, which is something that there have been criticisms of so-called standard science in the past, but they're pretty weak, and they never replace the standard science with something else that makes sense. And that's something that I've done, and is there again is a major piece of work. So it's not just, my work is not just about comets or not just about the solar system. It's down to the subatomic level, it's up to the cosmic level, and everything in between, including planetary formation, on and on. Okay. But getting back to Carl Sagan, I will say this as a general statement. He's a person whose bad science has done more harm to the human race than any other individual that I know of, that I'm aware of, and I'm a student of history of science. I mean, if you take just the greenhouse effect, which morphed into the global warming trend, and then morphed into the global climate change, which is around today, that has been such a driving influence on society and control of water, ownership of water, etc. Just almost dominating daily life. You know, the absolute domination of everyday life with this theme that has no scientific basis at all. Okay. And just a caveat on that, when I was talking about Venus recently, Venus, the planet, this is where the greenhouse came from, because Carl Sagan needed an excuse for this hot planet that they thought would be Earth-like. All of a sudden, it's hot enough on the surface to melt lead, and they don't know why. So Carl Sagan makes up this greenhouse effect, where supposedly the high carbon dioxide of planet Venus atmosphere holds the heat in, and it just keeps building up and building up and building up. But there's a lot of things wrong with that. But the end point is that if it doesn't work, if the greenhouse doesn't work on Venus, that has an atmosphere tens of thousands of times more carbon dioxide than Earth, then how could it possibly work on Earth? And the answer is that it doesn't. And so anyway, the whole issue of warming and glaciers melting and things like that, we're coming out of an ice age. We're literally coming out of an ice age, and that's why there appears to be global warming, but to attach it to you driving your SUV up and down the road is absurd. But this is also a political football, because you will notice that even though there's been global warming anxiety or just the promotion of this concept for decades, nothing really has been done. Nothing has been accomplished. The other thing is that today, more than ever, the general public, especially in the United States, is scientifically illiterate. And it's simply because they've been taught a series of unrelated facts. They simply repeat things. There's no ability to logically talk to people in general. A lot of people listen to this show and over time they have started to put it together and understand at least the basics, some on a higher level. But let's just put it this way. Carl Sagan has for 50 years dominated science and pushed it in the complete wrong direction. At least this is what I'm talking about is tier two science. And of course, that's the goal. So he accomplished the goal of people who are the real controllers, because they don't want the public to know really what's going on. And it's just one charade, one in a veil, one facade after the other. Going on through history, but the basic core scientific standard principles are unchanged. And nobody can walk outside of that box or they will be fired, etc. So anyway, a good half century of marching down the wrong road thanks to one man named Carl Sagan. Now, one might imagine that I have an axe to grind, and it's a personal vendetta. And no, I'm above that. As I said, like when I went out into Canada, etc., when I came back from Cornell, I went out into Canada and spent 10 months in the wilderness. I had to rise above all of that, any personal vendettas, etc., because the whole issue here is putting forth real science. and recognizing exactly who is at fault for the destruction of real science and not allowing it to blossom and pour forth as it should have. One thing it did is it allowed me, because I work alone and because I understood I had the breakaway in front of everybody understanding all of this, and that's very complicated, very extensive, but it allowed me to the space to pursue all of this on my own and get to the level that I'm at today. And that's continuing. I have possibly some of my greatest discoveries yet to make. I'm working on problems that are mathematics, physics, and other types of problems, archaeological problems, that are still in need of answers. So I'm still pursuing. I'm out on the cutting edge. But knowing that the public is really being handed a big set of lies is very disconcerting to me. And just another point on this, do I have a vengeance, a V for vendetta against Carl Sagan personally? It's a scientific issue. It's a scientific issue, and that's exactly where it stands. I'm, just to be clear, you know, if I would have stayed at Cornell, it may have locked me into the place where I wouldn't have made some of my other great discoveries, such as the prime number work or the Nazca lines. You have to understand that somebody is guiding my path. And when things happen and when things change, they're for a reason, because it puts me in a different position. It puts me on a different path than I would have been. So staying at Cornell, I was there for the two prime years. There was, you know, and after that, things tapered off. So I was there during the primo years, took advantage of it, and then went on a different path, which was very important because it led me to where I am today. So I wouldn't have this radio show. I wouldn't have the public awareness. Many things would have been going on, and all I can say is that's not the road that happened. And so we can, in all of our lives, we can go back and say, well, what if I would have, say, married this person, or what if I would have gone this direction or gone to that university there or done something? We don't know because it didn't happen. But you can possibly take a heart in the idea that your life is more has benefited from those twists and turns, sometimes things that you didn't choose to do, but you were confronted with, but you're better off now because of that, even though at the time it certainly wasn't clear. It's at the time it seemed like the most horrible thing that could happen to you in the world. Okay, so enough of that, but this required some serious time because it's such a major event in the scientific progress, in my scientific progress, and with scientific progress in general. And may I remind you that back in the Middle Ages, it was 300 years that the Copernican system, in other words, the system understanding that the planets revolved in orbits around the sun, it took 300 years to crack that particular topic and bring it into mainstream. And the main resistance there was the Catholic Church. And so anyway, interestingly enough, today the Catholic Church, you would think, what are they doing in the scientific world? Well, they are very integral in controlling this narrative of standard science. In fact, the Pope, current Pope Francis, a number of years ago, sought physicists and cosmologists with the Big Bang to coordinate with theology from the Vatican so that they would be consistent. And now you have to scratch your head a little bit, because wait a minute, the whole core principle of the Big Bang is that there was no God, that there was no divine creator. This just happened all by itself. And that involved the evolution of the universe, the physical universe, the stars, the galaxies, the planets, etc. And then begins biological evolution that starts with nothing, basically organic molecules, and somehow you get up to intelligent man, and it eliminates the idea of the spirit of man, the spirit that lives in the body, that man is not just an animal. But the Pope requesting that cosmologists get together and corroborate the story of the Bible and of the Catholic message to the world, which of course is what, one third of the world population sits underneath that Catholic or Christian, and a lot of the breakaway Christian religions, Protestant, Lutheran, whatever, still fall under that, and the Pope is instrumental in certain aspects, even though there's been schisms, etc. But imagine that. So the Catholic Church, once again, is instrumental in maintaining this standard science, which is bogus. And so how many hundreds of years will it take to bring to fruition my work and understanding? And this is, by the way, why I'm doing this radio show. Can you imagine if we had Galileo or Newton or Riemann or Cauchy or Gauss, recordings of them and their lectures, etc., from hundreds of years ago, but of course there was no recording devices at that time. So the reason I'm doing this history, this year-long history of my discoveries, is because people read my books, they read my work, they look at the science part, but they don't know where it all came from. Where the history, where was I, how did I get to these places, what was the historical content, what gave rise to these beliefs that I, in my pursuits, and why was I doing this, why was I working on certain problems and not working on other problems. So that's why I'm doing this, is for posterity. Because someday, and like I say, Tier 1 science already understands that I'm perfectly correct in everything I'm doing here, but how long is it going to take to break through and bring this to the general public? You have the glossy magazines, this entire presentation, television, glossy magazines, for the public newspapers, NASA news releases, etc., all Tier 2 science. But how long is it going to take for the real science to break through to the public? Anyway, a couple minutes or less than a minute left in this particular broadcast. Just want to remind you that these broadcasts are brought to you commercial free. The only support I get are from the purchases people make on my websites. JMCCSCI.com is the traditional website, the main website, and then my water filter page, JMCCWaterFilters.com, and your purchases support my work and primarily the overhead to bring you these radio shows, pay the airtime. I pay my own airtime, by the way, and that allows me to be commercial free. I don't have sponsors, certainly no government support. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.